So I was glad that when my father looked at the sources, he at least realized I'm going to talk about something that nobody understands. So by the way, that was just this is an old trick of teachers to take the expectations down. So if no one understands it, so then how can I explain it? So let's take a look and see what it is. In the first source, let's get exactly up to context. The previous thing that it had said was that the luchot were completed. Hashem gives it to Moshe, but then there's a pause. The pause is, he goes, listen, by the way, your people have messed up, and so on and so forth. I'm going to get rid of them. And Moshe prays. And that's all that takes place on the mountain. And we get some level of forgiveness, because afterwards Moshe is going to continue and pray again afterwards, and the story gets broken up. So there's really two prayers that Moshe makes. One prayer, maybe even three, you can argue. One prayer that he makes before he comes down, another when he's down, and then he goes up and prays again another time. And then the final forgiveness apparently is by Yom Kippur, which is also mentioned in this week's parasha. Now, when Moshe comes down the second time. Now, if we look at all that, right after we have the first level of forgiveness is where we're going to start up today. Vayifen vayired Moshe min ahar. Moshe then turns. So now you understand what the turn is. That, you know, till now Moshe has been engaging God. Now he turns. And he begins his descent. Vayifen vayired Moshe min ahar. Ushnei luchot ha'idut biyado luchot k'tuvim mishnei avreim mizeh mizeh hem k'tuvim. And why at this particular juncture was significant to add this description of the luchot, I don't know, but that's something which is worthwhile noting. And it adds now more, v'haluchot ma'aseh elokim hema v'mechtav mechtav elohim hu charot al luchot. And luchot are the act of God, and they're written in the handwriting of God, the writing of God, and they're engaged on the luchot, which means that the luchot themselves are some type of act of the divine. I mean, the only reason I'm saying this now, because I don't want to focus on this, but when Moshe comes down, he's going to break the luchot. Right, and that's right after this. In Pasuk Yutet, Moshe is going to break the luchot. It almost seems to be that there is this parallel which exists, and the parallel is, maybe it's a surprising parallel, because we can ask, what was the purpose of the Egel? And generally, the commentaries point in two different directions. One direction is that the purpose of the Egel is that it's to replace Moshe. The other possibility is that the Egel is to replace God. I mean, because they make this very strange comment. They say, Moshe, the man who took us out of Egypt, we don't know where he is, aseleno Elohim. So, you know, which one is it? Is it to replace us? So one does get the sense that those who say it's to replace Moshe is somewhat of a, for lack of a better word, is a cop-out. I gave a talk yesterday in Hebrew on a different topic, and I asked how you say cop-out in Hebrew. No one knew. Nonetheless, Ibn Ezra, the Kuzari, they like this approach, and I understand why. You want to defend the Jewish people. I presume that Rav Levi Yitzchak Mebeditchov would have gone in this approach. You want to try to minimize as much as you can what the outrage may have been. On the other hand, if you minimize the outrage, then you have to then say, ask a different question. If the outrage wasn't so bad, then why was God so outraged? And the way that God describes it, to the point, that's it, I'm wiping them out, I'm getting rid of them, so if it wasn't all that bad, so then why does God respond that way? And that is, at the end, you know, when everything is said and done, that is going to be a weakness within that approach. So let's just keep that in mind. So the basic way of looking at it, does this replace Moshe? By the way, if we take the Moshe theme, and this is something I've spoken about in the past, you have this wonderful irony that the way that it's described is Egel Masecha. What does the word Masecha mean? And we're getting close to Purim already now. What does Masecha mean? So in a certain... What?
A mask or a mold.
A mask or a mold. So, but it's very interesting that by the end of the parasha, Moshe is the one who's wearing the mask. And Moshe is wearing the Masecha. And therefore, it's like you thought Moshe was a man, Moshe Ha'ish, and they stress that, Moshe Ha'ish, which is also a little strange. If Moshe the man isn't here, then why are you going to replace him with some kind of an idol? So there seems to be saying that men are fickle. Yes, half the people in the room will agree with that. Men are fickle, and men will break our hearts, and what do we need a man for? Let's get a good ego. And that is much more satisfying. But by the end of the parsha, okay, let me add one more thing. And basically by saying that Moshe is a man, they see, it says, Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe. They see that Moshe is not there. And that's where this wonderful rabbinic interpretation comes in, that they see an image of him dead. They see an image of his body, you know, dead, no longer with us. Why? Because how can a man be away so long and not take supplies with him and still possibly be alive? How can Moshe be gone at this point for 40 days and not have any food with him? So what's the answer? Moshe can be there for 40 days without food and without drink, which means Moshe is not exactly the man that we thought he was, and Moshe is something else. And the problem with all this is we get to some very strange territory. Of course, again, I'm going to say it again at the end, with Moshe even having horns. I'm sorry for saying that. But at the end, of Moshe even having horns, the similarity between Moshe and the eagle is one that you can't miss. So, what's the matter? I told you Purim was coming. What's the matter? You know Moshe had horns, right? No, but I don't mean horns like that. I mean, Karan, he had a glow, but the glow looked like... You saw the artist's rendition. Rays. So how do you say ray in Hebrew?
The same way as you say horn.
Right, so there were rays of light coming off of him. But what color were they? Like the sun. So what did it look like? It looked like a golden calf. Moshe looked like a golden calf. Don't you get it? Anyway, No, that was the whole mistake, because that's why they wanted to replace Moshe with a golden calf, because that's what Moshe looked like. What's the matter?
Right,
but I'm saying, but that's the great part. Moshe's a man. No, Moshe's not a man. So Moshe comes down now, he looks like the golden calf. Anyway, what's the matter?
She forgot where Moshe.
Okay, so let's
actually, I think
this is
for the I'm being serious, but okay, let's continue. I am. It's the only thing she's going to remember what I said today. So let's continue then. There is, though, another possibility, and that is that the parallel should not be between the eagle and God, and the parallel should not be between the eagle and Moshe, but the parallel should be between the eagle and the Luchot. And that's what they can't have. They can't have both. Which means, again, there's a question that maybe we'll get a chance to deal with it afterwards. It's very strange that Moshe takes the luchot from God, then comes down, and then throws them down. So it seems like, okay, you're going to break them, so just leave them there. Why bring them down with you? But it would seem to be, again, if you think about it, what was supposed to happen, the luchot is supposed to enter into the place, which is going to be the holiest place. Again, eventually we're going to build the Mishkan, the center of the Mishkan. We're going to put the luchot. Of course, there's this other very uncomfortable aspect of the luchot, is that we're going to build an aron. On the aron, we're going to put two gold things, which, again, is something which is very uncomfortable to us. The whole kruvim. So I'm saying the analogy between the kruvim and between the eagle is not such a bad analogy, but if I'll go a step, especially if you're going to take into consideration the vision of Yechezkel, where he sees this four-sided thing, where one side is a kruv and the other side is an eagle, and the foot is actually like the foot is an eagle, one of the faces is the face of a bull. But especially in terms of that kind of symbolism, but now you realize the very epicenter of the holiness is going to be where the luchot are going to be placed, with the kruvim, with the cherubs on top. And on the other side, you have this eagle now, which is their replacement, which is now the epicenter and the place of holiness and what they're praying to. So what I'm saying is that the real contrast over here should be a contrast between not the eagle and God, and not the eagle and Moshe, but really the eagle and the luchot. And therefore, when Moshe comes down, and the full reality of what they're doing is in front. And again, I'm going to be even clearer. Aaron, all the way through over here, Aaron is very interesting. And the basic tactic that Aaron takes is a stalling tactic. And you can argue with me about this, but I won't back down. Aaron does two things along the way here which indicate the stalling tactic. One is he says, fine, I'll build something, bring me all your wife's jewelry. I cannot see that in any way but a stalling tactic. Okay, bring all the jewelry, and then we'll continue. Again, I would think that in Aaron's mind, okay, that's it. There's nothing more to talk about. And then it says, Kol Am, all the people bring it. I know as much as the women don't want to or like to claim they were not a part of the sin, it says all the people bring it. So again, how'd the men get the women's jewelry? But that's the first stalling tactic. The second stalling tactic is he says, after the finished build, they build it. Lush and Robin, they build it. They build the eagle, and after they build it, then he says, okay, it will be a holiday for God tomorrow. And very significantly, which name of God does he then use? Yud He Vav He. He does not say Elohim, he doesn't say the eagle, he doesn't say anything else. Aaron is focused on God, one God, the eternal God. And so this is the second stalling tactic. It will be a holiday for God for tomorrow. Now, even though I just now said it's a stalling tactic, he actually means it. Which holiday was it supposed to be tomorrow? The holiday that was supposed to be tomorrow was Simchas Torah. It was supposed to be Simchas Torah in its most basic possible sense. Why am I calling it Simchas Torah? Because Moshe's coming down with Luchos, and there's a Simchas Torah. But now, if you think about it, the people did everything right, except for one little point. Meaning, they were eating, and they were drinking, and they were dancing, right? And all of it, well, the one thing they did wrong was they did all this around the eagle. What were they supposed to be doing? Around the Torah, because it was Simchas Torah, which means, again, I want to stress that the real focus over here really is the contrast between the Luchos and between the eagle. And that's where the fundamental mistake comes down, and therefore when Moshe comes down with the Luchos, so then he sees what's going on with the eagle. So, okay, then you can't have the Luchos. You can't have both. You want the eagle, you can't have the Luchos. And by the way, what does Moshe do? He breaks the luchos. What does he break right afterwards? He breaks the eagle. And once the eagle is broken, now he can go get new luchos. So I'm just saying is that this comparison, even though you were laughing at me before, but that was with this is actually much stronger than you would originally have thought it was in terms of this particular contrast. There's also the wonderful comment of the Meshech Chachma, who nobody knows it because he doesn't say it here. Whenever you don't say something local, so then it becomes obscure. But the Meshech Chachma says at a much later point that the reason that Moshe breaks the Luchos is he says something very simple. He says if they can worship something which is man-made and something which is basically, again, an idol, then they will end up worshiping something which is holy. And therefore the whole description over here of the Luchos being holy and divine, something which God makes, he says they're going to end up worshiping it. Which is Meshech Chachma, which is then very close to a statement of the Kutzker Rebbe that the Jews can turn anything into idolatry, even Torah. And there's so much truth to that, we won't even go any further because we don't want to say not nice things about Jews. Okay, so now, I just skipped over the two verses I want to talk about. Back in source number one, Moshe comes down, he has Luchos in his hands. Then, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, it says, right, we're just told the Luchos are described as being divine, the act of God, the writing of God. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayishma Yehoshua et kol ha'am birei'o Vayomer el Moshe kol milchama b'machaneh. And Yehoshua hears the sound of the people of the nation. Birei'o will skip. And he says to Moshe, there is a sound of war in the camp. Vayomer, how would you translate Vayomer? Vayomer, how would you translate Vayomer? Vayomer, he said. No? Vayomer is he said, or? Vayomer, ein kol anot gvura, it's not the sound of victory, ve'ein kol anot chalusha, and there's not a sound of being subdued, of weakness, kol anot ani shomea. I hear the sound of, well, I don't know what the word anot means, so aside from that, I would translate this. These two verses are actually a little difficult. One difficulty which you may not have sensed beforehand, and maybe we'll come back to it, is we don't even know who's speaking in the second verse. I know you all know who's speaking, but we don't know who's speaking. Is it Yehoshua? Is the whole dialogue is Yehoshua? Whole monologue is Yeshua? Or is there a dialogue where Yeshua speaks and Moshe responds? That even though I'm saying it's very clear to you, the text is not clear. We basically have two verses over here stuck in the middle, which are either absolutely related or not. It actually reminds me of two verses that have nothing to do with this. And those are the two verses that are stuck in the middle, right between Moshe's being by the snare and Moshe coming back. We have the two verses where, for lack of a better term, Moshe goes to a hotel, right? That Moshe goes to this Malone, and something happens in those two verses, which is completely mysterious. Here we also have two verses. I'm just going to point out two commentaries before we start. Look at the Emek Dover, the Netziv, in source number 2. He says, "Vayishma Yehoshua, zeh ha-sipur ein bo davar le'inyan ha-egel l'firaut." He goes, at face value, this story has nothing to do with the story of the egel. Now you say, hold it, what are you talking about? He said, this is a complete non sequitur, or a parenthetical statement. This has nothing to do with what's before, has nothing to do with what's after. Now, I think he's overstating it, but he's, and he continues, he says, V'raku ba bezeh la'ir b'mkomo al inyan shenimtza b'midrash kohelet, ala pasuk shiftei v'ra'ah, shnei dvirim ma yeshu l'fnei Moshe v'lo matzachein, haynu kan v'et shemar adoni Moshe kal'im. That, no, this could just kind of point out that there were two things that Yeshua had said at some point to Moshe that were inappropriate. One is here, and one is when all the people are prophesying in the camp. And then he said, you know, silence them. Or perhaps Kalem even imprisoned them. But you can look again, and Siv just said this. He goes, oh, no, this has nothing to do with anything. This is just pointing out that Yeshua spoke inappropriately to Moshe. So he obviously understands the first verse is Yeshua, the second verse is Moshe. Yeshua says something, Moshe corrects him. And Moshe does not accept Yeshua's analysis. And what in the world is this doing over here? Doesn't fit easily. The Or HaChaim may say the same thing even stronger in the third source. V'yishma Yeshua, tzorich ladat mahu kavanat omro b're'o. We have to know what it means b're'o. Uma kol zeh sheshama. What did he heard? Gam tshuvat Moshe tzricha, navi lagid mashmura dvarim. You need to be a prophet to understand what is being said over here. And I'm not 100% convinced I'm reading it right, but I may be. Yeah.
I have a question. Where was Yehoshua? I didn't know that they had been paying.
Okay. Now that's a great question. Where is Yehoshua? So there are a number of possibilities where Yehoshua is. And why does Yeshua not know what's going on? We don't have as much information as you would have thought about it. I know for some people it's perfectly clear where Yehoshua is. If you look at source 21, Pasuk Yud Gimel, we'll just read that Pasuk. Vayaka Moshe v'Yehoshua Misharto. What does that mean? Vayaka Moshe v'Yehoshua Misharto. Vayakam, right? Vayal Moshe al Har Elokim, and Moshe went to the mountain of God. Okay, so where's Yeshua? That's the information that we have. Moshe and Yeshua go up, and then Moshe goes up. So what is Vayakam and what is Vayal? So where Yehoshua is actually, we're left here with quite...
The next pasuk implies he didn't remain where he was.
It implies... But it's not clear, because what's the distinction over here? So where is he? The easiest thing to say based on this is that he's someplace in the middle. Is that... Yeah, he's someplace in the middle. That Moshe ascends, and we're only told that Moshe ascends, but we're told that Yeshua does something with him, so it seems to be that they leave the camp together. Moshe goes up, and therefore Yeshua is standing and waiting. And by the way, the same way you can ask, you know, how does Moshe subside without food for 40 days and 40 nights? Okay, what was Yeshua doing for 40 days and 40 nights sitting over there? By the way, there's a whole midrash about this, that Moshe, that he's in the middle and comes to teach you, that the man fell specifically for Yeshua, and he had his own man source over there, and meaning the difference is Moshe doesn't need food, but Yeshua does need food, but God took care of him miraculously. But I'm saying that there is this whole treatment of Yeshua making the assumption, which I see no reason to argue with, but making the assumption that Yehoshua is someplace in the middle between heaven and earth, while Moshe is up all the way on top. But by the way, this idea of Yeshua being in the middle, which means he's not quite like everybody else, but he's not quite like Moshe. And another way of us thinking about this is Moshe is like the sun and Yeshua is like the moon. But that comes back to the same point of the Netziv, is that even though Yeshua is on the higher level of everybody else, but he's not on the level of Moshe. And there are those who see this as a veiled attack against Yehoshua. Let's again quickly look at source number 12. Vayishma Yehoshua et kol ha'am b'ra'ah, she'em amtin l'rabo b'makom she'hinichu sham. He was waiting for his master in the place that he left him. U'kishishama ha'kol, and when he hears the voice, chashav she'yu mirivin, elum elu, v'amar kol mochama b'machane, v'nei Yehoshua einu nitzal mita'ut. He was wrong. Listen, what does it mean that Yeshua heard Moshe could hear exactly as well? Moshe's coming down and Moshe doesn't miss anything. And now you realize this was the same midrash that really the Netziv was working off of, but it does... The way that he's describing it, again, the way that he phrases it is that, or framing it, he's framing it in terms of Yehoshua being halfway to Moshe. And he's halfway up the mountain, but he's not Moshe. And therefore, it's stressing that he's not Moshe. And stressing he says things about Moshe, and Moshe doesn't accept him, doesn't accept what he says. And that's why this is what this verse is doing over here. And by the way, all that helps us, but it doesn't help us at all, because we still do not understand at all what this conversation really is. And as much as the Emek Devar, the Netziv, wants to tell us that this is a complete, you know, not connected at all, others try. Now, the word which was difficult for us was the word bireo, right? That's the initial thing. Vayishma Yehoshua. Yehoshua hears et kol ha'am bireo. He hears something which is called bireo, and he says to Moshe, his interpretation of what he hears is kol milchama b'machaneh. His interpretation is that there's war. And then, okay, so let's look at source number 4. You'll see at least one attempt, bireo. Vayishma Yeshua et kol ha'am bireo, hafach erev, which means ki otam erev rav heim shavdu, which means it sees the bireo, he hears the erev rav. Now, I hope that none of you are convinced by this, but this midrash is not just looking for the erev rav, it has a difficulty knowing what bireo means, but it also does something which is the opposite of what the Netziv said, and what's that? It's absolutely connecting this with the with the sin of the golden calf. Targum Unculus, and we'll see how many of you get the reference that he's making in source 5. Vishama Yeshua yat kol ama kad miyavivin. So what does miyavivin mean? Wailing or crying, and what is it connected to? And what does it have to do with the word? What word was used? Trua. That's the sound of the sound of the trua, right? Back to Rosh Hashanah now. We already had Simchas Torah. Now and Yom Kippur. Now we're back to Rosh Hashanah. What is the sound that the shofar makes in Rosh Hashanah? The trua that it makes. So the way it's described in the Gemara is the wailing of the trua. Now what word was used? Bireo. So over here, the Targum Onkelos is apparently understanding that there's a wailing in the camp. The wailing is like the sound of the shofar. Which sound of the shofar? The shofar makes different sounds. It's the trua. You all know which one the trua is? Well, none of us really know what the trua is, but that's the whole problem. But the trua is supposed to be a crying. It's a sound of a crying. So the question is, what kind of crying is it? But that's what the Targum understands here. On the other hand, the Targum Yonatan writes, Vayishma Yeshua et kol ha'am kasher miri'im v'simcha. In Aramaic it was Vayishma Yeshua yat kol ha'am akad miyavivin b'chedva. So again, he has the sound of the blowing of the shofar, or the sound, but b'simcha. And the Targum here is one more thing, b'chedva kodam igla, the sound that he hears, which means, by the way, there's two different parts of this pasuk. There's the objective thing, what he hears, and then there's the subjective interpretation of what he hears. Correct? Objectively, what does he hear? Right? Again, Vayishma Yeshua kola am kashem ri'im b'simcha lefnei ha'egel. What does he hear objectively? He hears the crying out, but it's crying out with joy, which again, he misinterprets. It's the people screaming like banshees in front of the eagle as they're serving or dancing or singing in front of the eagle. But what's his interpretation? He says to Moshe that it sounds to me like it is war in the camp. So he hears something, but this is an interpretation. So that's Rashi b'Re'o b'Hariyu shayu miriim usmechim b'tzochakim. Yeah, so Rashi is using v'kol ha'am achlu v'shatu v'kamu l'tzachek. That's objectively what we're told about it. And also machalot, which is either means dancing or it means drums. So this is what they hear. Ein kol anot gevura, ein kol azenira kol aniat giburim hatzoakim nitzachon v'lo kal chalashim shotzoakim vay. I don't hear the sound of the victim. I mean, if it's war, let's keep something in mind. War in those days was fought hand to hand. So if war is, again, it was very personal, very up close and personal. So if war is taking place hand to hand, you will have the sound of the victor and you will have the sound of the
vanquished.
Vanquished is what we wanted. That was clearly vanquished was waiting, not loser. Come on. And he says, I don't hear either of that. There's some other sound over here which is taking place. The Radak understands Bereo to be within the kind of... By the way, those of you who don't know, the Radak is very careful with language. He wrote a book on language. He understands, and here he's interpreting a verse in Micha, Atolamat tir'i ra, inyana inyan trua le'evel, kimo v'trua be'etzarayim, Sham umimenu et kol ha'am bireo, which means he understands all this as a mourning type of cry. But it's still the connotation we're getting across the board over here is one of crying. The Ibn Ezra says black and white what we intimated before. V'yishma Yoshua shenishar b'tachtit ha'har. So again, we go back to the location. Where is Yoshua? He's been waiting for Moshe at the bottom of the mountain. He leaves the camp. That's what it means, vayakam. He left the camp, but he never went up the mountain, so he's been waiting at the foot of the mountain, away out of the camp where all the other people are. Bireo migzerat trua. He says it comes from the same word as, the same root, the same word as trua. When you hear the sound, a sound which is going out. Be'et tzaharayim. Sorry. I lost my place. Sorry. Gzer trua. Kamo. Right, we'll skip. Pasuk Yudchet in the Ibn Ezra, in the next end of the next line, Vayomer, and he says, Omar Hagon, that's Rav Sad Yagon, Kigam Eila Divrei Yehoshua. He says, Yehoshua is still speaking. Ulafida Ati Shehim Divrei Moshe. And he goes, I think it's Moshe speaking. So again, I'm pointing out, if we didn't have enough confusion beforehand, and I really did intimate this earlier, that the Ibn Ezra's even raising, we don't even know who's communicating with one another. We don't know who's the one who's speaking at this point. Is it Moshe? Is it Yeshua speaks and Moshe responds? Or the way that Rav Sadigun wants to read it, let's just read it again that way. Yeshua hears a sound of the people as they are crying out, and he says it's the sound of war. And then he says, on second thought, it's not a sound. I don't actually hear the sound of the victor or the sound of the vanquished, but rather I hear a screaming coming out. But it's not clear exactly. So what he's saying then is that I really don't know what it is that I'm hearing. What's the matter? Yeah.
I just want to suggest that Yeshua's maybe primed to think about war.
Good.
More as
good.
A,
we'll come back to that.
Perfect.
Perfect. We'll come back to that very soon. In Source 15, the Malbim writes, Vayishma. Vayishma. So that's how it starts. Vayishma Yehoshua. Yehoshua hears. He hears a sound. Vayishma. Yeshlom Moshe Moshe Higid Li Yehoshua Ma Shekatav Lo Hashem. V'kasher shema kol tura shebemachaneh zeh shemar lefamim al milchama. Amar kol milchama b'machaneh. V'zeh siman sheyesh mekaneim al masa egel ad she'amda milchama bin shnei hakitot. So, what? Well, okay. I think the plural is ketot. It's kat is singular. I think it's plural is ketot. Okay. Moshe knows something that Yeshua does not necessarily know. What's that? He knows about the eagle already. He knows about the eagle because God told him. He already prayed. And that's exactly, he turns around and he starts to come down. The Malbim's adding that Moshe already has this initial talk with Yeshua and tells him what's going on in the camp, which, of course, again, is ironic, but you have Moshe who has information Yeshua doesn't have. And then Yeshua says, well, I hear in the camp war. And if I hear war, what does that mean? That there's resistance, civil war. That means there's resistance and that you have those who are sinning and you have those who are fighting back. Again, I'm going to read it again. Yesh lomer shemoshe gid li Yeshua masha katav masha amar lo Hashem. He said what God told him. What's that? That they made an eagle. V'kasher shema kol tura shebemachaneh shezeh morah lefamim al milchama, and that occasionally can mean war. Amar kol milchama b'machaneh v'zeh siman sheyesh mekaneim ma'aseh ha'eagle ad she'amda milchama ben shnei hakitot. That means that there's resistance and there's fighting and that there's a civil war going on in the camp. Those who are worshiping and those who are fighting against it. V'yomer Moshe, imaya kol kol milchama yatzrich li shemesh shnei minei kolot. But if there is a war going on, then I should be hearing two types of sounds. Kol shel ha-menatzchim shemashmi'im kol gvura v'tura nitzachon. Those who are screaming out in victory, v'kol ha-menutzachim, and those who are defeated, shemashmi'im kol shever v'yalala shehu onot chalusha. Ve'ein achad mishnei eila rak kol anot v'tza'aka. He goes, I don't hear two sounds, I just hear screaming going out. I don't hear two different types of things. So the discussion over here seems to be between Moshe and Yeshua regarding what is going on in the camp. But by the way, of course, you can ask yourselves, okay, so what? Just go down and you're going to see what's... Yeah.
Would this be a defense about Israel on the part of Yeshua?
Of course. Of course this would be a defense. That, you know, if there are those who are protesting and those who are fighting back, so then obviously Am Yisrael's position would be that much stronger. Spoken like a good parent. Let them work it out themselves. Okay. Someone's going to call the police on us, by the way, after they hear this. Kol chalusha, and now we'll get back to Charlotte's point. Kol chalusha, what does chalusha mean? Wheat or the defeated. So the Rashbam points out, chalusha nitzachon, kidichtiv, and look for his reference to that, v'yachlosh Yehoshua. Yeshua is the one who defeated Amalek when they went to war. So if anybody should know what the sound sounds like, so the Rashbam is just pointing out the similarity in language, but I think the similarity in language may actually indicate something which is far more important. The Meshechachma, Vayomer el Moshe, Kol Milchama b'machaneh, Inyan al pima da amr mesechet ta'anit. Okay, and we'll skip a little bit. V'kan re'ui hayel Yeshua l'nkom nikmat Hashem, ki hu nucham b'charbo im Amalek. V'ze sha'amar kol milchama, do yasavur sha'amalek ba'ot pam lilachem b'Yisrael. Okay, this is not like we had just seen in the Malbim. The Malbim is saying that Yeshua has information that there is, in fact, the sin of the eagle. But when Yeshua hears the sound of war, what's his assumption? Again, let's just process what the last time he heard the sound of war was Amalek came and attacked them. So he hears the sound of war now. What is his assumption? According to the, what? His assumption is that Amalek is back and Amalek is attacking the Jews. So this whole sound that we hear over here is a fight between the Jews and Amalek, never dreaming that it's actually the sound of the Jews worshiping a golden calf. Continue. Ve'ein zero shalei savno for elo biyado zero shel Rachel, k'demer perek yeshnoch, and l'chein haya al yidei Yoshua sheba mi'efraim b'noshi Yosef, yomer, Moshe kol anot anochi shomea, sh'ata lo shamata, rak ani shamati, sh'ma mina sh'bididi toli hadavar, l'chein yitzev, and so on. That basically what he's trying to say is that Yehoshua is hearing this, and Yeshua is interpreting this, and Yeshua is thinking, okay, this is my role, this is my job. Moshe's not getting involved here, but again, he doesn't know what Moshe knows. And these whole two verses is Yehoshua is hearing something and then building a whole narrative around what he hears, getting ready to go back to battle, getting ready to go and lead the Jews against Amalek. But of course, that's not going to be the reality. I do want to point something else out, which... if we look at the Battle of Amalek, there's actually a very, very strong parallel to what is taking place over here, whether we recognize the parallel immediately or not. The parallel, probably more than anything else, is because of what it doesn't say here. But I'll explain myself in a second. By the Battle of Amalek, we have four people singled out. Correct? The four people singled out are Yehoshua, in no specific order, Yehoshua, Moshe, Aaron, and Hur. These are four people who are singled out. The way that they are aligned, we'll come back to in a second, but the four people who are singled out are the same four people who were singled out in terms of what's going to happen with the eagle. Which means over here, if you look at Source 18, Vayavo Amalek v'lachem im Yisrael b'refidim, Vayomer Moshe el Yehoshua. So here it's Moshe and Yehoshua, but he says, you're going to choose men and you're going to fight b'Amalek Machar. By the way, the Machar element also comes in terms of the eagle. As I said before, Aaron says, Chag l'Hashem Machar. Anochi nitzav Arasha Giva. I'm going to go to the top of the mountain, which by the way goes back over here. Where's Moshe when this is taking place? Moshe is on the top of the mountain. The difference over here is going to be that Yehoshua is down below, and Moshe is on top, which means you have a complete separation between Moshe and Yehoshua. Even though there's a separation, there's still a correlation. And what's the correlation? The correlation, what? And what else is the correlation? Is that when Moshe lifts his hands, then Yehoshua is victorious. When Moshe's hands come down, then Yeshua is losing. And by the way, that's the nitzachon, that's the gvura, and that's the chalusha, the sound of the victor, which means Yehoshua actually was intimately acquainted with both sounds, because that's exactly what takes place during the battle against Amalek. You have the sound of victory and then the sound of being defeated and Moshe's hands. Now, who's holding up Moshe's hands? Who's the one who's supporting Moshe? So that's Hur and Aaron. So, again, Umoshe Aaron v'chur alu rosh ha-giv'ah v'yakashay yarim Moshe yado v'gavar Yisrael v'kashay niach yado gavar Amalek. And now what sound is going to come out there? Again, the sound of the victory and the sound of the being defeated. V'dei Moshe kvedim, Moshe's hands are heavy v'chu evan v'sim tachtav yashay alev Aaron v'chur tamchu b'yadav mizeh echad u'mizeh echad. So they are tomech Moshe. They give Moshe strength. Then v'yichalash Yehoshua tamalek v'tamolof yicharev. And then Moshe, then Yehoshua weakens them with the sword. By the way, the sword is going to come out soon, also within the narrative of the eagle, when Moshe says, you know, every man take a sword and go out, which means that there will be a battle here as well. And then finally, v'yomer shem Moshe katov zot zikaron v'sefer v'sim ba'oznei Yehoshua. You have Yehoshua's ears. Where else do we find Yeshua's ears? By Yishma Yehoshua. So I'm just pointing out that even though maybe you would say, oh, what does one thing have to do with the other? They may have much more to do with one another than you ever would have imagined before. Now, what happens next? Well, then there's this other narrative that we need to consider as well. The other narrative is in Source 21. That's what we started to read before. Vayakom Moshe v'Yeshua mishartov v'yal Moshe al harelim. Here Moshe goes up and Yeshua is someplace, as we said, in the middle. Ve'elazekinim amar shuvu lonu b'zeh ad asher nashuv aleichem v'nei Aaron v'chor imachem mibal dvrim yigash aleichem. saying who's the one who's in charge? The ones in charge are Aaron v'Hur. So, of course, the great mystery... Okay, before we get to the great mystery, the obvious parallel over here is that it's the same four people who are the ones who are in charge. There's a difference now. What's the difference? That by the battle against Amalek, Moshe's on top, Yeshua's on the bottom, Aaron and Hur are the ones who are supporting. Here, Moshe's on top, Yeshua is someplace in the middle, and Aaron and Hur are still supporting Moshe. I just want to point out, they're still the ones supporting Moshe, even though the support at this point is not a physical support, like when they're holding up his arms, but they're the ones who are supporting Moshe. They're the ones who have now have replaced him, at least temporarily in terms of leadership, which of course then you have to ask yourself the obvious question. So we have two capable people, Moshe's right hand and left hand man, who are there to help him, and somehow this does not work out very well. So of course the question is, why does this not work out well? Those of you who don't remember, Aaron is the man who will become Kohen Gadol, and Hur is the man who will be king. Of course, he never is, but he's the one who will be king because he's from the tribe of Yehuda. So over here we have Yehuda and Levi, right? Yehuda and Levi supporting Moshe, who of course is also from Levi, but one Levi is going to become the Kohen, and that's the Kohen Gadol supporting Moshe. You have then the person from Yehuda. So you basically have different types of leadership. The real leadership of Moshe at the end of the day, and don't argue with me about this, is not so much that Moshe is a melech, even though we have discussion about Moshe being melech. Moshe is really the absolute personification of Torah. So we have Torah over here being supported by the, if you want, the here you have Keter Torah, Keter Malchut, and Keter Kehuna. Over here you have three types of crowns of Judaism over here who are at the top of the mountain, and they're the ones who are the spiritual source for Yeshua to be able to fight and to be victorious below. And Yeshua ultimately gets his strength from Moshe, who gets his strength from Hur and from Aaron, respectively. So, Moshe leaves, Yeshua goes with him part of the way, and Aaron and Hur remain. Now, the great mystery, as I started to say before, is basically the verse which begins the whole golden, which you don't have in front of you right now. It says, "Vayar ha'am perek lamed bet pasuk aleph. Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe leredet min ahar." The people see that Moshe has delayed in coming down from the mountain. How do you see that? And by the way, the other thing is, which is very simple to you, because most of you have been indoctrinated, but it's not as simple to me as it is to you. How do they know when Moshe was to come down? Was there ever any conversation beforehand? How long he's going to be away? None of that is there. You know, again, on the midrashic level, we're told 40 days, but I don't see any evidence for the 40 days before then. So their confusion over here is not necessarily just a confusion because they miscounted, like we like to say, but he's gone for a day, he's gone for a week, he's gone for a month, he's gone more than a month. At what point do you say? Now, Vayar ha'am ki boshesh, they see, so that's where the midrash comes, that they see his dead body. They have this, the Satan comes and shows him the dead body. Why? By the way, you can take this literally or you can take this psychologically. What do they see? It's their fears that they see. What do they see? It's their concerns. They see this is not possible that this man is still alive. It just cannot be. So therefore, they see Moshe's dead body as in a sense, that's really the Yetzirah and their lack of belief. Vayar am ki boshesh Moshe leredet min ahar. They see Moshe's delayed. Now listen to how strong the language is. Vayikahel ha'am al aharon. What does that mean? Vayikahel ha'am al aharon. They congregate, kahal. They congregate al aharon. What does that mean? If you don't hear it, there's a great deal of intimidation in that verse. Aaron feels intimidation. Vayomru elav, and they say to him, again, they're scared because Moshe's not here. They gang up on Aaron, and what do they say? Vayomru elav, kum asei lanu Elohim, asher yechul lefanenu kizeh Moshe ish, asher elenu meretzitzrayim lo yadana mehayalo. You get up and make for us a god or gods, because we don't know what happened to this man. Moshe took us out of Egypt, which means it's not that Aaron comes and says, well, maybe I'll make a golden calf today. It's they are ganging up on him. Now, of course, and he feels completely intimidated. And what's the great mystery? Where's Chor? The great mystery is, where's Chor? And Chor is never heard from again. So according to Chazal, there's a cover-up. And the cover-up is that as bad as the sin of the golden calf is, there's something even worse. And the thing which is even worse is, and that's the point the Torah doesn't even want to say because it's so bad, that they did the exact same thing to Chor. And Chor's response was, over my dead body. And their response was, fine. And that's what happens to Chor. So Aaron seeing all this, and that's where Aaron moves into what I said from the beginning, was he goes into a tactic of delay. Give me your wife's jewelry, a holiday for God, Yudke Vavke, tomorrow, which means he is trying to do what he can to delay it, which means Chor will be king. He takes this position of confrontation. Aaron, who is going to be the Kohen and try to work things out, he takes the position of a non-confrontational approach. But his non-confrontational approach, as I said, I know where his head is at. I'm not reading into this at all. I know where his head is at, but he ends up going, as I said, taking this non-confrontational approach. And of course, you can add to his motivation is because he sees what just now happened with Chor. So that's the background. I'm saying, but that's of course the obvious mystery over here when God says Chor and Aaron are the ones who'd be consulted when there's a problem. So there was a problem. Chor is gone. Why is Chor gone? It's not just that he decided, well, it's getting a little cold, time to go down to Florida or to Eilat for a couple of days. I mean, Chor is so noticeably missing that we can't ignore it. So when you now realize, again, what Sharif is saying is right. It's not just that Yeshua is attuned to battle. It's that the battle that we're talking about over here is one where there was a certain constellation of leadership over here, and we end up having the people rebelling against that leadership. And we see it clearly with Aaron, and we strongly suspect it. And now, in terms of Chor, and now we have him standing on his own. The Mahari Karo makes an interesting observation, just in terms of what he hears and what he imagines and what he thinks he should be hearing. What was the last piece of information that we had regarding the status of the camp? So it's interesting. Look in source 19. Vayishma Yehoshua et kol ha'am, yeshtak shochim, Yehoshua mar kol milchama b'machaneh, ma hashiv lo Moshe in kol anot havli lememe in kol milchama. Aval ha'kavana ki shekiblu Yisrael et ha'torah, ra'a Yehoshua et Yisrael ki him kulan ba'ava uva'achva lekabel Torah kumo shemamu chazal v'yichan Yisrael. Which means, what was the last piece of information? Ki ish achad, b'lev achad, total unity. So if I hear a sound of battle, then what happened to the unity? But by the way, unfortunately, it sounds like even in the Golden Calf, there was more unity than we would like there to be, because there was not this resistance that we would like to imagine. Rav Hirsch adds in another element, which maybe you never thought about, but I think he did the math. Now, let me just go back before we read him and just think this through a second. So we'll talk about indoctrination. The other piece of indoctrination is that women have always been told that women were not part of the Chet HaEgel. Okay, I accept that. Seder, we accept that. Who could bring me evidence against that from Rashi? Or possible evidence against that from Rashi? So Rashi says, Achlu v'shatu v'chomel tzedchek. Rashi's tzedchek is Gilei Arayot. So if there's Gilei Arayot over here, which means that there's a sexual sin breaks out as well, and as I've pointed out before, that when the Jews get forgiven for the golden calf, the forgiveness becomes represented by Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, we are not allowed to eat, not allowed to drink, and not allowed to be involved in sexual behavior, which goes back to the exact sins which were a part of the golden calf. They ate and they drank and they were involved in sexual sins. So Yom Kippur, which is the healing, we stay away from it. Okay, so that I think is a direct correlation. Now listen to what Rav Hirsch adds into this. Kol anot. Now, by the way, anot was one of our problems because we don't know what the word anot means. Hava omer kol mashpil umachlish should have been sounds which were degrading. Kol hamevi alav ripui in koach, the type of sound that takes away strength. Lo atchuva v'ahed shekolot elim orim bilibo marpim et yadenu ela kolot atzmam umahim meviim dahinu holalut hamusarit hamurmezet ba'otei and so on. Ra'o. Efshar gam sha'anot mitzayin hachalasha v'chilul b'muvan hamini. He says it's also possible that the word anot has a connotation of weakness and desecration in terms of sexuality. Kine'emar nashim b'tzion inu, that the women of Zion were violated. So he knew his understanding in terms of violation. V'harei misurat b'yadenu shehanashim lo hishtatfu b'maseh ha'egel. We have a tradition that the women were not involved in the egel. Im kein yomar kan shemashchu et hanashim b'koach el ma'agal ha'holelut shemisaviv la'egel. They forced and they raped the women and they brought them into this terrible orgiastic outrage that was taking place, which means what Hirsch is adding in, again, he's just doing the simple math. The women were not involved, but we find Gilei Arayot. So he says, no, they were raped. They were forced into this. Again, those are the exact words that he used. And came Yermar kan shemashchu et anashim bikoach. The women were taken by force. El ma'agal ha'holelut shemisaviv la'egel. In terms of this, how do you translate holelut? Wilding. Yeah, do better than that. Debauchery. V'hitnagdutan garmalahen sevel rav. And the women trying to protest or trying to resist is what caused them a great deal of pain, which is why the word inui is used over here, or anot is used over here. So in terms of what it is that they heard, Rav Hirsch, as I said just now, threw a whole nother element into this, which we did not immediately hear or were sensitive to. So the sounds that they're hearing, this is what he's saying, is that, okay, no, war, it's not war, it's sounds of screaming, whatever, what kind of screaming, which means there's an outrage taking place over here. Let's take a look at the Chatam Sofer, because he flips everything around. Kol milchama b'machaneh. Yir'eh Yehoshua ben Nun, hitzitz beruach hakodesh, v'lo yada man niva, ki kol anota egel, he kol milchama churban beit hamikdash. So he says, what does he hear? He hears where this sound is going to reverberate over the years. Which means, again, the day the Egel is destroyed is Yud Zayin, the day the Egel is worshipped is Yud Zayin B'Tammuz. That's the day the breach which within the city, that's the beginning of the end of Jerusalem. What he hears is the reverberation. Again, it's a basic correlation. If the Jews can stand by the foot of Mount Sinai and they can make a golden calf, 40 days after hearing God say, I'm the God who took you out of Egypt, do not make any graven images, and they can make a graven image and say, here's the God that took us out of Egypt, you realize that something is profoundly wrong, which means if the Jews have this capacity of ignoring what's holy, then ignoring holiness, so then later on in the future, holiness will be ignored as well, even if it's the holiness of the Beit HaMikdash, in the same way that the luchot, which are made out of stone, are thrown to the ground, and you know that's something which is holy, rocks which are thrown to the ground, which are divine in a sense. The same way, the walls of the Beit HaMikdash, the walls of Yerushalayim, those stones are going to lose their holiness as well. But what he's saying is that's what Yeshua hears. Yeshua hears the reverberation of this sound, not just what's going on now. He hears the scream of the 17th of Tammuz going out throughout history. That's what he hears. V'amnam Moshe Rabbeinu Olav HaShalom lo hisigze. And Moshe didn't hear it. So it's very interesting that he's, again, we had those commentaries from the very beginning, the Nitziv others who were saying that, no, it's these are the cases based on the Medrash. These are the cases that Yeshua didn't understand, and it's really a condemnation on Yeshua's eventual leadership that he's not on the level of Moshe. Okay? By the way, that's an acceptable point. Who is on the level of Moshe? And over here, the Chatam Sofer is coming and telling us the opposite. Why? Because God hid this from him. The Ilu Nichnas Moshe Eretz Yisrael Lo of the Avodah Zarah, v'lo nachar Beit HaMikdash, v'yeshua hisigata kol milchama churban Beit HaMikdash, v'mirzlo, sh'li yikanes Moshe Rabbeinu l'Eretz Yisrael, v'lo ratzel l'mroz l'Moshe Rabbeinu l'Ava Shalom. That Yeshua, who is part of Israel, and Moshe is only part of Chutz La'aretz, Moshe doesn't need to hear this. Yeshua needs to hear this. Yeshua is going to the land of Israel. God spared him. So again, just to understand, how could it be that Yeshua hears something Moshe doesn't hear? God spared him because Moshe doesn't need to have that pain of hearing or seeing, of having this premonition, not just that they're worshipping an ego, but this means that the Beit HaMikdash itself is going to be destroyed in the future. The Chatam Sofer in Source 25 comes back to this in another one of his books. And he writes, V'yamashem Moshe, kol melchama b'machaneh, pirush degam Yeshua hevin shu kol anot, v'rak shesavrahu, notain she'iv she'yishtaku at tzadikim l'maseh zeh, v'yesh melchama b'machaneh. Which means he understands, again, Yeshua understands everything that Moshe understands. He knows that they're worshipping the eagle, but he thinks it's impossible for such an outrage to take place without there being resistance. There must be some Jews that are getting up who are going after them. It's just not possible otherwise. The gam Moshe chashav gam kein zeh, and Moshe also believed there must be some resistance. Why? To be high time he vi haluchot v'lo hinichim l'mala. Because that's the reason that he took with him the luchot down and didn't just leave them back in heaven. O shivrim l'malo, break them back in heaven. Ki chashav, he thought, sheyesh bem tzadikim v'rak asher ba, but when he came, there was no war taking place. There was only the sound of, shall we call it, the celebration, as it were. And that's why now he comes to this realization. Now he needs to break the luchot. So what have we really seen today? We saw two verses which are very difficult to understand. So the two verses which are difficult to understand, what Yeshua hears versus Moshe hears, we've seen basically two approaches to it. One approach is that Moshe understands what Yeshua doesn't understand. The other approach that we have is that Yeshua understands that which Moshe doesn't understand. The other thing is this whole context of war so much fits into who Yeshua is, and it's the war, and it's the weakening, and it's tomorrow, and it's the cherev, and all that, which means when we went back and looked at the whole narrative in terms of the fight against Amalek, we realized how many of these elements are here as well. But of course, they're here, but they're not here, which then leads us to the most important character who's here, but who's not here, and that's one of the people that Moshe left to be in charge, and that's Hur. And that's why, again, Hur, the text is absolutely silent about Hur. But if what Chazal tell us what happened to Hur, that they murdered Hur because Hur resisted, on the one hand, it's this even stronger condemnation against the Jews. Then just for good measure, then they're guilty of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, and Shfichut Damim. Right? The three major sins, idolatry, sexual sins, and murder, are all there together represented by the eagle. And that's one element. And again, Rashi really, he doesn't say it in those many words, but that's really where Rashi is leading us. But once you realize that there was protest, right? Who protests? Hur protests. And what happens? The angry mob comes and kills Hur. That may very well have silenced any other protest. What happens next is that Aaron then takes this non-confrontational approach, which again, you can just think about the difference between the personality of a king versus the personality of a Kohen. What a king is supposed to do, what a Kohen is supposed to do. The king is confrontational, where the Kohen tries to make peace and tries to work things out of the way. That's why the Kohen can give us the blessing of peace. And we have two different approaches over here. Aaron, from everything we see, was never involved in this in terms of an emotional involvement and never thought it serious. And his whole approach over here is, as I said from the beginning, is one of a delay tactic, which he does more than once. But unfortunately, not only doesn't work, its confrontation was tried and it failed. Non-confrontation becomes now the action or the strategy. But when Moshe and Yeshua now are facing it, they're processing all this. So is there confrontation or is there not confrontation? That's what these verses are about. Which means I hear war. No, I don't hear war. I don't hear the victor. I don't hear the subdued. Which means they're trying to figure out. And again, Moshe at least knows what's going on. and maybe Yeshua does, and they're trying to work this out. So that's what we see. And again, once you see a verse or two verses with so many commentaries, then you, of course, you know the difficulty with it. And when Yeshua hears war, so he thinks, Amalek is back, Amalek is back, maybe he should... Again, all of this is part of the difficulty we have over here. But I do think, just to conclude, I do think that this issue of that you would have assumed there would be confrontation, and now the non-confrontation is what's confusing, and that's really what the two verses tell us. Confrontation, no, there's not confrontation. The whole background for that is because there was confrontation. But the confrontation didn't work. Hur was killed, and now we're back in, and now we're in plan B. And that's what Moshe and Yeshua don't understand as they're coming down, because how can there not be confrontation? Because they don't realize how it worked out. Yeah. Yeah, but I will point out one more thing, and we'll end with this, that this confusion of sound does present itself in another place, at the exact opposite side of the spectrum. And when's that? Matan Torah, you have lots of sounds, but also when they build the second Beit HaMikdash. If you look at Source 14, at the description in Ezra, and you'll see actually now how close this is. And the only question here is why I could not find any commentary who said this. That's the only question. Look at Source 14. Right? Many people who had seen the first temple, right, they make this big sound, this right, and this crying, and bitrua bisimcha laharim kol. You have sound, traveling, you have this confusion of sound going on, celebration, crying going on, and that is what Yehoshua thinks that he hears initially. It's this celebration of the building of the second Beit HaMikdash, which is, of course, very interesting, because because it means the first one's destroyed, which means the first one could be destroyed in Shavuos Batamuz and so on and so forth because of the whole Egel. And now you can realize, again, these verses in Ezra are the closest description that I found, at least, to what we have over here on the mountain. A confusion of sound, happy or sad, but of course over here, what's the reality? It was both. Why is it happy? Because we rebuilt the temple. Why is it sad? Because we rebuilt the temple. Right? Which means that itself encompasses both sounds, but that may be part of the confusion. So I'll just take the Chatam Sofer and go one step further. That if what Yeshua is hearing, the reverberation which is going to take place in the future, it's not only the sadness of the reverberation of destroying the temple, but also we found the exact same thing manifest in the rebuilding of the temple.